My name is Marjorie Wildcraft, and I'm the founder of the Grow Network, which is the premier community of people who are growing their own food and making their own medicine. This next presentation I have for you is the most impactful interview I've ever done in my life, and it's on the topic of AI, which is artificial intelligence, and the future of food. My guest is Dr. Kai-Fu Lee, who is an expert in AI. He spent more than 30 years focusing on this. Early on in his career, Dr. Lee distinguished himself by creating a game-playing program that beat a human world champion. He later went on to found Microsoft China, and he has held executive positions at Apple, SGI, and he was the president of Google China. So he has really been at the edge of technology. Dr. Lee currently is a venture capitalist with his own company called Sino Ventures. Dr. Lee is also the author of a hugely profound and impactful book called AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley, and the New World Order. And in this conversation, we're going to discuss AI and the future of food. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Lee, for coming and talking to the members of the Grow Network.
Thank you.
And I've read your book, and I have to say that I've read voraciously, and your book was the most impactful book that I've read in at least a decade or two.
Wow. Thank you.
Yes. And I would say of all the big nuggets that are in there, the number one that just like hit me was the job loss, the coming tsunami in jobs.
Yeah.
And could you share with our community the what your predictions are?
Sure. Well, artificial intelligence has been my area of study since 38 years ago. And it only began to work in the last 5 or 6 years. So it's just coming. Artificial intelligence is not human intelligence, but it is an ability within one single limited domain for machines to do things that are routine that people can do. So it's not a displacement for our brains, but it is an ability to do simple routine things better than people. Things like customer service, tellers, deciding whether to give a loan or not, deciding what investments to make, financial, and internet, of course, all over Google, Facebook, Amazon, people are being displaced. These are white-collar kinds of jobs. In blue-collar kinds of jobs, beginning with visual inspection, some parts of agriculture, you know, automatic harvesting in the farms.
Basically almost everything.
And then assembly line, and then drivers. Mm-hmm. So when you add up all of these jobs plus other jobs, there are probably 100 types of jobs, adding up to 800 million worldwide, leading to anywhere between 30 to 40% full or mostly displacement by technology. So this means, in the case of a blue-collar job, a machine, a robot, can do a better job. Mm-hmm. In the case of white-collar job, it means the job is sent just to a cloud server and the job gets done. So, you know, we talk to a customer service rep. In the future, on the other end, will be a computerized voice, not even a robot, just software that talks to you but sounds like a human. When you go get a loan, there's not even a human. It's an app you download and you click, I want $300, and it comes directly to your phone. So these changes are happening in the next 15 to 20 years, and the number of the percentage of jobs impacted is estimated to be anywhere between 30 to 45%.
Wow. Now that's going to be, as I said, a tsunami of job loss. And,
it is.
You know, we've all seen, and as you've pointed out, we've all seen the blue collar jobs go with factory automation. And now AI is encroaching on the white collar jobs.
Yes.
I've done a lot of interviews with others, and they've said, oh, you know, we really don't need to worry about this because, you know, look, humanity has gone through the steam engine and electricity and all these other hugely transformative technologies, but you're saying actually AI is different for several reasons. Mm-hmm. What would you say to those people who say, no, you know, it's going to, some people lose jobs, but it's going to create a lot of others? What?
So first, I acknowledge that in a 20-25 year horizon, AI may create more jobs than it displaces. Just like if you look at internet, it created a lot of jobs. Let's take one example, Uber.
Yes. Right?
The Uber and Didi, that's the Chinese Uber drivers, number in the 10 million. So it's a big category of jobs created by the internet 20 or so years ago. But at the time internet came about, no one knew what job would be there, and it took 20 years. So if the job losses begin in 5 years and continues through 15 to 20 years, we can't really wait for that mythical new job that AI creates. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that AI, because it can do almost all routine jobs, will likely create non-routine jobs. Because if a job that AI creates were routine, then AI would just do it. So now look at the 30 or 40% of the routine jobs whose job that people lost. And then let's say there are an equal number or even larger number of jobs, another 30, 40, or even 50% of jobs made available, but they're non-routine. So the transition and the training will be substantial. Imagine someone in a routine job, let's say assembly line worker, who wants to become someone in a non-routine job, let's say airplane repair. That's easily 2 or 3 years of training.
Yeah.
Or someone who is in a routine job, let's say cleaning up rooms, but going to a non-routine job like nursing, that's easily 3 or 4 years training. So that's a big issue. That's number two. Number three is, steam engine, electricity, internet, computer were all big general purpose technology revolutions, but AI will be faster because AI is instantaneously usable for white collar displacement because we already have cloud. Cloud already has AI. Someone who wants to implement a displacement for, let's say, a white collar position of a customer service rep or telemarketing or telesales, all they have to do is use Google Cloud and Google Duplex, and they can build their engine immediately for the company. So the displacement will be much faster. It's not like electricity where you have to lay out the electrical grid and wait for a lot of things to happen. Could be decades or even a century, but AI is faster. So yes, there are similarities, but for these three reasons, there is a greater urgency to alert people that jobs may be disappearing, and there needs to be governmental action and corporate action to make sure there's social welfare to take care of the people, and also retraining so they can move on with their new beginning, their new lives.
There's a lot of problems with that. I also see with the retraining, we all know that, okay, I may retrain for a job, but then that may be replaced by AI also. So there's, it's tough.
So it's important to be retrained in a new job that's not displaced. And that's not known to everybody. For example, you might or might not know that, for example, a plumber's job is not displaceable for a long time because every house, every plumbing is different. So AI can't do that. Yet,
it's hard to get a good plumber right now.
That too. So we should train more plumbers. Yet an auto mechanic job in 10 years will be dramatically fewer and different skill set because there'll be electrical cars. You open the hood, there's not much to fix. It's a computer, it's like a phone. And then also many of them will be autonomous. So the entire skill set of the current auto mechanic for the fossil fuel cars will be outdated in another 20 years. So vocational schools should slow down that training and train more plumbers. These are things that are obvious to us, but it's frustrating to see that people don't get it.
One other difference that you had pointed out in your book that will accelerate this and is the influence of venture capital, which wasn't available for those earlier technologies.
That's right. Yeah, because in the days of electricity, Tesla and Edison had to persuade people to loan them money to build their enterprises, and that's hard. Turns out Tesla wasn't very good at it. This is not the Tesla the car, but Nikola Tesla. And Edison is a brilliant communicator, so he persuaded some people and got the loan. But today, if there were another Tesla and Edison, they just have to talk to VCs who are very smart and who will take all the risks, so an entrepreneur doesn't have to take all the chances. If you have a good idea that has a decent chance of success, a VC will take all the downside and share your upside. So that will accelerate the new ideas that will either improve the economy, make money, or display workers and save costs.
I think also people don't know that Nikola Tesla, back in his day, because he had such new innovative ideas, his friends, I think they actually put him in a mental institution for a while.
Yes.
Whereas now, if you have good, brilliant ideas, people throw money at you. So yes, it's a very different environment.
Yes, you could argue Steve Jobs, Elon Musk are a little bit unusual, but now we treat them as treasures, right?
Yeah.
But before, Alan Turing was another example, who actually was essentially died because of various things that he did that was viewed as eccentric or unacceptable socially. So I think, brilliant minds will have a better chance today.
Actually, I'm really glad you brought up on Elon Musk, because, you know, I've seen those videos and Elon is like, let's all be afraid, AI, it's going to take over, it's going to be smarter than we are, it's omnipotent, you know, be careful, it's going to kill us all, you know, he's got this horrible. Let's go back, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier about the single domain, but, you know, should we be afraid of AI? I mean, I'm looking at, oh my gosh, Elon, you know, the master of technology, and if he's freaked out, shouldn't I be, you know?
Well, everyone has a domain of expertise. Elon Musk's expertise is not in AI.
That's true.
It's in entrepreneurship, space exploration. He's very talented, but he's influenced in AI by a couple of key thinkers. But that's not his expertise. So when I published my book, AI Superpowers, all the inventors of deep learning and many of the experts in AI really came and thanked me, because they felt brilliant people like Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, Dr. Henry Kissinger, all made various comments about AI. They mean well, and they believe what they said, but they don't have the domain expertise. So the road towards this dystopia, or this true human intelligence, or artificial general intelligence, is a very long road with many challenges and breakthroughs needed that will likely need at least 20, 30 years, if not centuries. So I think the prudent thing is, let's be on the watch out for this super intelligent technology, but let's not freak out unless we see any evidence, any shred of evidence it might happen. And today we have no shred of evidence. What is incontrovertible, however, is that these job displacements, these single domain optimizing, like Excel on steroids, is taking over more and more domains. So I think our energies should be focused on things that will happen in the next 15 years with 100% certainty, rather than things that have some small likelihood of happening in many decades.
If I can give an example from agriculture that might highlight what this single domain means, and you can tell me if this is accurate or not. So just like antibiotic resistance, so we take more antibiotics and then the germs figure out how to thwart that, and we now have antibiotic resistance, which is a huge problem. In agriculture, there are weeds that are becoming resistant to the herbicides that they use. One in particular is a form of amaranth, and it's commonly known as giant pigweed. The first initial reaction that most farmers had to that in the industry, the commercial agriculture, was to just spray more and more of these herbicides. Actually, I find it quite sad that often in our fields where we're growing food that humans are going to eat, the people that tend it are wearing hazmat suits, which is pretty frightening. But one thing, so one company has come up with an implement they put on the back of the combine. And they have trained an AI. They gave it 10,000, 100,000 pictures of giant pigweed. And this AI learned to identify that one plant.
Yeah.
And the good thing about that is now when that combine goes through, that AI finds that plant, and then they spray the herbicide just on that plant. So they're not wasting, which is a big expense, but they're also not creating that much toxicity anymore. But that AI that learned about the giant pigweed, it's never going to figure out on its own what corn looks like, or soybeans, or your children. I mean, it's never going to figure anything else out. It only knows
That's right.
what giant pigweed is. So we don't need to be afraid about, because it does look so slick. You know, I'm talking to Siri and it all looks so magical, but it really has only learned in one, as you call it, a single domain. So it's
That's a perfect example. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Let me talk about another global trend, and let's see what the impact of AI is on that. And I believe it was Forbes or possibly Fortune that just came out with an article that said the top 6 billionaires on the planet right now have more wealth than the bottom 2.5 or 3.5 billion people. So we're seeing, and this has been a trend that we've been seeing for years and years, this concentration of power in the hands of a few. How will AI impact that trend?
It will make it worse. So it's because both, I think, starting with computer technologies and internet technologies and mobile technologies, they've created these ultra billionaires, and we don't see them in any way hurting our lives, but yet wealth is being shifted this way. Mm-hmm. If you look at the top 20 companies, most valuable companies, they're almost all tech companies now, probably 70%, and many of them are internet, mobile, or AI companies, and in many cases, all three. So Google, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, China's Alibaba, Tencent. So wealth is on the one hand being pushed to the few, ultra, ultra wealthy, 100 billionaires in the future, and maybe even trillionaires one day. On the other hand, technologies are being used so that repetitive work and routine jobs are being devalued, because starting with robots and some internet technologies and software, enterprise software, and now AI, more the jobs that they displace are the lowest paid jobs in the society. So you have both things happening at the same time. So it is a, you know, doing damage to the fabric of society, because in the early days of America, the growth of the middle class, while there were ultra rich, there were not that many. And then more and more of the poorer people had a dream. They could move towards the middle class, and many were realized. We see the same thing happening in China maybe 50 years later as China opened up. However, in the last 20 or 25 years, the trend has gotten worse. If you plot the curve of the top 1%, it goes like this, how much wealth is owned. The bottom 50%, it goes like this. You can plot any number you like, the top 6 people, top 2%. However you plot, it is very clear wealth is shifting from the less wealthy and then to the ultra wealthy. And I think more technologies will exacerbate that. It's not an intended consequence, but kind of a collateral damage or side effect. And I think it's incredibly important that governments figure out a way to deal with that. We can see the recent divisiveness in the UK, the US, and many other countries is largely a outgrowth of this phenomenon, is the people not going from have-nots to haves, but from haves to have less and some to have-nots. And that causes discontent and causes divisive countries. So I think it's a huge issue. It's made definitely made worse by technology. And it's something really desperate for some kind of a solution.
I agree. And then there's a saying, absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yes.
And I would like to tie this back to food again.
Yeah.
And I can. So, you know, as adults, I've seen and you've seen just really egregious abuses of power or individuals, governments in different ways. And I've always been like, why aren't people out in the streets over this? You know, why aren't we, you know, what's going on here? Why don't people get, you know, outraged about this? And sometimes there's some spunk, but by and large, people seem pretty complacent. And so I spent a lot of time researching. You know, what is the cause of riots? You know, what causes people to get so incensed? And I'm not the only one who's interested in this topic. And I was browsing on one of MIT's websites, and I saw an article on the cause of riots. And it was done by a group called the, I believe it's the Institute for Complex Systems. And you would think that the cause of riots would be a whole bunch, there's a whole bunch of variables, and they were very shocked, which I bet you'll appreciate, that it actually came down to just one element. Now, the riot may have been for, some sort of political or social justice, or that might have been the exterior reason, but the one variable that they found underlying all of it was the price of food.
Mm.
And they were able to chart and predict very accurately when the price of food got over a certain level in an area, they knew that rioting was going to break out. Now, they wouldn't know what the social reason would be.
Mm.
And it, just as parents, we both know that if as a man you are looking into the eyes of your children and you have no way to feed them, then it will motivate you not only to go outside and get in the streets, but it will motivate you to go to the square and douse yourself with gasoline and light a match.
Yeah.
So we do see a lot of...
The cause of revolutions are the same.
The same, yes. And actually,
although we haven't seen many revolutions in the last 50 years, but if you look a few hundred years, they're the same.
The Romans used to say, give them bread and games and they'll never revolt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
So agriculture, and do you see, feeding people, because we really need to focus on social stability going forward with all the topics we've been talking about.
Yes.
I've been seeing some advances. Like, I think one of the companies that you're invested in is actually coming up with robotics to pick food.
Pick fruits,
because harvest is a very manual intensive.
Yes. Yes, I think if we look at agricultural technologies and how they might intersect with various types of advances in biology and chemistry, as well as AI and robotics, I think we can sort of separate them into two parts. One is advanced food technologies. One of the big advances in China was the hybrid rice, the hybrid rice grains. A little bit controversial, because people question whether that has side effects, but undoubtedly it has fed many Chinese who were going hungry 40, 50 years ago, no longer. And so they could have crops that can have two seasons, so twice as much crop to feed more people. But one might question, is it truly safe? I think it looks okay, but that's one type of things that really changes the nature and the chemistry of the crops themselves. And of course, we know that various American companies are doing different types of things as well. So I would imagine your audience are probably not a big fan of that. If people are already fed, I would think we should not go into that. We should go more natural. To the extent people are going hungry and dying, I think those are options that might be viewed as temporary solutions, because anything's better than starvation. So that's kind of one set of technologies that alters the quality, the content of the food in order to feed people who are hungry. The other is technologies that don't in any way, shape, or form hurt the safety of the food. So we think examples like computer vision recognition to give more accurate watering, fertilizing, pesticide, and picking of the fruits are technologies that I think are better than the current alternatives. So actually, AI is a big boon to agriculture. And the barrier is coming down. One of the interesting examples I saw from Google from the use of TensorFlow, which is their AI technology, is one engineering-oriented farm boy in somewhere in the Midwest solved a big problem for his parents. He could categorize cucumbers based on computer vision. It's because they were harvesting a lot of cucumbers and they have to separate them into different sizes, whether there were little holes and what quality, so they had different grades. And that's things that AI can do, so why have a human do it? So I think there are many imaginative things that could be done with absolutely no harm added to the agricultural process itself. And that's why I think AI, as it applies to agriculture, will be value add, because AI is not there to, is there to improve the process, improve the, save the money, and do more targeted, reduce the amount of pesticide. Everything I've seen as AI application to agriculture has been positive.
You know, I read that same story and I thought how delightful that, you know, most of the AI platforms are open source.
Yes.
And this was just a young man, and I think he spent a few months, and he saw the labor of his parents during harvest time and was able to relieve it and build these systems. And it took a bit of skill, but it wasn't like he was some super PhD. You know, it's accessible to a bright young person these days.
So yeah, if there could be an agricultural community that shares the, you know, sorting of all kinds of vegetables, and then that could reduce a lot of time and yield more profit for the farmers.
I'm going to circle back to agriculture one more time, but I was also really deeply touched by your story. You had a tremendous wake-up call in your life a few years ago that had you begin to really make some distinctions about technology versus the human element and possibly come forward with some a more hopeful perspective on this. Would you talk a little bit about your story?
Certainly. I've been a workaholic most of my life through about when I was 50. And when I was 52, I got fourth stage lymphoma. And that diagnosis was a shock to me because throughout my life, I didn't worry too much about exercise, eating healthy, getting enough sleep. I certainly loved stress because stress was also exciting. And then those turn out to be the four factors that are likely to induce cancer, or at least high correlation. And that because I was able to get away with it for 52 years, I just thought maybe I just have one of those bodies that cancer doesn't like. But I was wrong. And I think one wake-up call was I really need to become healthier and really think about the, and I had a great doctor who came to me and said there were four things that matter, and sleep, and eating healthy, and exercise, and reduce stress. So I followed that, and that was one of the wake-up calls. The other wake-up call, maybe even bigger, was on the spiritual side. That is, I always just thought the purpose we have in this life is to maximize our impact through the job that we have. So if you're a professor, win Nobel. If you're a business person, become CEO. If you're an investor, make $1 billion. These were the measurable, quantifiable things that we should run every day to maximize in our lives. And then when I got hit with the news that I had fourth stage lymphoma, first was, of course, shock and denial and anger and eventually acceptance. Once I reached acceptance, I looked back on my life and realized that the going after the quantitative wealth and fame and through work was very shallow. It's one of the things that we could do, maybe should do in life, but it's not the most important thing. And the way I knew that was because for a month, I thought I only had months to live. And I knew for sure I didn't want to spend one day of those few months working, that I wanted to thank all the people who've helped me and spend time with the people who love me and that I love, and maybe do one or two things that I really enjoy. And work was not even on the top 20 list.
It wasn't okay, right? No, isn't that funny how your whole life just changed?
Change upside down. Yeah. And I think people shouldn't wait until they face death to realize that work isn't what life is about. It's a part of what life is about. It's something that is useful, but we really have to balance our time. And the book that I read during my illness called The Five Regrets of the Dying by Bronnie Ware, who was a caretaking nurse of the people facing death. And she took care of over 2,000 people, and she did a statistics that none of them wished they had worked harder or made more money. And all the wishes were like the ones that I had the epiphany and realization. It was about spending time with people you love and who love you. It was about not being told by society of what we should be, but asking our heart what we should be. And they were about doing things that we love and not just fall into the day-to-day routine of doing the same thing or the repetitive work. And it seems obvious once you see it, but many people fall into this downward spiral of working harder to get some success with that as a stimulus, feeling like we have to work harder again, getting some more success. You feel like you're climbing the corporate ladder, but you're actually going on a downward spiral to turn your life into a very monotonous slave to work. And I think looking back, while my cancer was very painful, the treatment was difficult, but I'm glad I had it because it woke me up. And I'm fortunately in remission now, and I live my life differently. I wrote this book to share my thoughts, yeah, not to make more money or become more famous, or and I spend more time with my friends. We go out on vacations to, you know, Japan, Thailand, and so on, with my family and with my friends. And then with my family, I change my priorities. I used to put work as the top priority. Whatever time I had left, I gave to my family. Now, whenever my kids have vacation from school or work, I drop my work. And I said, tell me what days you're free. I come, you come to us or we come to you. We have to spend family time. Yeah. And when my wife faces stress or has a happy moment or an anniversary, I make sure that I'm there. So I put that as a top priority. It doesn't mean I'm no longer working hard. My work hours may have dropped 20 or 30%, but it wasn't like it went down to 30 hours a week. I still work pretty hard. But with that reduction of 15 hours a week, I was able to take better care of myself, eat more healthy, get more sleep, get some exercise, and also spend more time with the loved ones and have some fun and enjoy life and experience it.
That cancer truly was a blessing then, because that really is true wealth, that the love of your family and friends.
Yes.
And yeah, what a beautiful,
thank you,
what a beautiful gift to give to the through your book and your message, and one of the reasons I've been so excited to
thank
interview
you,
because that's also,
yes,
one of the values.
Uh-huh.
Going back to food production again.
Yeah.
So many of the people, actually what the Grow Network is we're the premier community of people who grow our own food and we make our own medicine.
Mm.
And many of us, just as you were talking about machines, they'll never have the human component. You know, when I'm growing food, when I grew food for my family, food that's grown with love is an entirely different thing. Right? Mm. The commercial agriculture, in spite of all the GMOs and the pesticides and herbicides, it also is planted and tended and harvested and processed and never with a human hand touching it. Mm. And the food that I grow in the backyard, I'm engaged with that. And many of us know, intuitively, we talk to the plants, we're working with our chickens or rabbits, there,
yes,
is a communication and a connection, and actually more,
yes,
and more scientific. I did an interview with Monica Gagliano recently, who is a scientist with a lot of peer-reviewed research, where similar to Pavlov's dogs, she has trained plants, learned that they learn, that they remember, and of course that they communicate, and she's just one of many, many researchers. And the act of backyard food production is much more involved and much more healthy. And I'm wondering of your perceptions on, and I know it's such a humble thing of getting in the backyard and it seems so,
yes,
but we're talking about these issues of consolidation of power, but having people who have their own supply of food and resiliency could be a good counterbalance to that particular issue. And then the massive job loss issue, first of all, the commercial food supply, quite frankly, is toxic. And I appreciate your comments of at least we're feeding people, but,
yes,
but it's also just pushing the problem a little bit further down the road.
Mm.
But the food that you grow yourself is deeply nutritious. And it also may solve part of the job in that, one person full-time growing the food for a family of four, it's very deeply meaningful work and a good ratio. Also, that food that they're feeding them will reduce all their medical costs and so many other things. So I'm curious of your impressions from your perspective of looking at these global issues, if you see that as a as one possible way to help be an antidote for this tremendous change that we see coming.
Actually, I do, because when I first came to America, I lived in Tennessee with my brother, and he grew all the vegetables put on the table.
Mm-hmm.
It was mostly because the Chinese vegetables weren't available in Tennessee. And also, he knew he could use minimal pesticides and high quality natural fertilizers that we could eat healthier. So that was one of the most enjoyable times when we saw, you know, he would bring home a winter melon this big, that we said, wow, never knew this could be this big and so delicious, sharing with friends. And actually, when we had when later my wife and I had a house, we would grow our vegetables. To be honest, we had a gardener help us.
Of course.
But still, ever since 2005, even till today, we have some vegetables in our yard. And
thank you.
And it's we don't fertilize it at all. So it comes in with little holes from bugs. But that's a way of the world sharing, right? And a sign that this is safe. So we really enjoy eating the more delicious vegetables. I don't think we grow enough to feed the whole family. But we pick the things that we think will grow in the yard.
It really does help, even just growing some,
just
for the nutritional value, because so many of our soils are depleted now. But you know, you can really grow a good amount of nutrition in a small area.
Some of it tastes really good, like the romaine lettuce. It's just not like what we get from the. So we try to grow the ones that taste a lot better, and then also use no pesticide. So I'm very much. I think it's something. I think when my wife and I were younger, it was sometimes fun. We harvest. I mean, we have the gardener help us do the planting, because I don't know all the tricks. But we do all the harvesting, and it's fun. It feels like you're using your own hands for the work. So in answer to your question, I think for people who love it, this is a great thing, because first, I believe they will tell themselves this food is good. And it is, but the fact that they tell themselves it's good is a little bit like the placebo effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yes, there may be, you know, lower pesticide, more nutrition, but the very fact that they tell themselves this is a great thing, good for me, good for my health, it tastes better, good for humanity, it will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. That's what the whole placebo effect is about.
I definitely agree with you that the thought and the declaration.
The thoughts, and I think whether it is a scientific process or some kind of self-healing, it doesn't matter, because we know it works. And also, I think in the day where AI is going to displace work, people need something to take their minds off. For the people who are near retirement or already retired, well, this is a guaranteed way. You can feed yourself no matter what chaos might come.
Mm-hmm.
For people who are still working, then this is something you enjoy doing. And with all the stress and challenges and issues potentially facing you at work, this is something you can look as a hobby, as something you enjoy. End of each day, this is something that will bring peace to yourself and reduce stress. So there are all these great things about it. And I wouldn't say people who don't like it should do it.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think people who do like it, this is one of the best things that could happen. Because most hobbies don't end up in nutrition and benefit to your body, right? It's good to have hobbies to, you know, play chess or play the violin, and painting, those are all good. But here is a unique hobby that is both satisfying, stress-reducing, and good for your health and your family's health, and ensures that you have a lifelong ability to feed yourself.
There's also really deeply meaningful work, which you may not be aware of, but because we have lost these gardening skills for the last almost two generations, I think the Victory Gardens during World War II was the last big push in America for people to really grow food. We have lost I don't know how many varieties of heirloom vegetables because it's some, depending on the study you read, anywhere from 75 to 93%. So they look at the catalogs back in the early 1900s and most of those varieties are gone now. The same with our livestock, so the pigs and the chickens. Many of them are gone because they need to be perpetuated by backyard producers. But the opportunity there is, so example, my father-in-law, Pops, we all call him Pops, he's grown a little, and he lives in South Texas, and he's grown a little tomato, which we call Pops's Porter, which in Texas, being able to get a tomato in the middle of summer is a huge deal. And he's bred this tomato, and it's not super tasty, but at least you have tomatoes in the summertime in Texas, which is a huge accomplishment. And you know, that tomato, we'll keep that down through the generations and remember Pops. And so there's a lot of really valuable legacy work. Almost all of our vegetable varieties were done by backyard producers. Historically, there used to be wonderful regional competitions where you'd get to get acknowledgement. And but also switching to AI, and you mentioned this, you know, you got some help from a gardener. I'm wondering if there could be a merging of technology going forward, because it is a bit daunting, you know, and quite frankly, with the changing climate and and all the and the toxic soils, I mean, there's all these challenges. I could envision, and I would love to see what your thoughts is where we create a, like an AI gardening helper, you know, something that's connected up to the weather service that'll tell you, hey, you know, cover your tomatoes because we know it's going to freeze tonight, or your water levels, you need to water now, or, you know, the soil needs this, or maybe help you identify that bug, or, and I think that that would be a very, very good thing to develop in order to help more people that are interested in this be able to do it.
Yes, I think your audience, if they can produce twice as much, then they can eat more and their friends can eat more and might become a business. So we have seen some AI companies. We actually invested in one called Droplet. Unfortunately, it's not doing that well.
And then there's another one, Eden. Are you not also in Eden?
Yeah, so it's watering, right? It's basically detecting the humidity of the soil and giving the right amount of water at the right time, but not more. So that when there's a lot of rainfall, it could conserve water. And when there's dryness, it could give just the right amount of water through drip and other technologies. So I think those are technologies that are natural. I wouldn't go too far just yet because honestly, AI is produced by two sets of people, mostly by commercially high volume usage. And this isn't high volume. And this isn't a lot of data that's available. So, you know, reminder to cover your tomatoes is not a large enough because this is a capitalistic society. So venture capitalists invest in what's popular and pervasive. But also, I would encourage for those who are kind of makers and know a little bit about engineering, maybe try something and share with the community. Maybe it could be developed as open source with some simple robotics equipment. Don't go too far. Do the pick the simple things that most people can benefit from. Maybe give it away. That's something, you know, like the cucumber sorter, and someone can do the tomato sorter, orange sorter, and maybe this community can produce things philanthropically and just for social responsibility.
You know, I'll start adding those threads to our forum where our community engages. So thank you for that. We'll create a whole technology side.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Lee, for your time. And I know that the members of the GROW Network are, they're very forward-thinking people. And this message of what's coming with AI is a difficult one. But, and I really appreciate you acknowledging and supporting those that are growing food as a viable path forward for regeneration and care. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. You're all doing some amazing work. I learned a lot today.
Well, as you can see from that interview, there are tremendous forces afoot on the planet. And in the coming decades, there will be an incredible amount of upheaval and change. There's a free resource I'd like to let you know about where you can take a quiz that will let you know whether your job is at stake or not. And that resource is at AIJobQuiz.com. And if you head over there, it's just a short couple of questions and it'll give you a real good indication of whether you're safe or not. They'll also give you an opportunity to buy Dr. Kai-Fu Lee's book and a package with a webinar deal. I strongly encourage you to read his book. It goes into way more depth on this whole topic of artificial intelligence, and it's extremely well written. Head over to AIJobQuiz.com, take the free quiz, and pick up your copy of the book.